Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Kate Roche and today I'm joined by Helen Taylor, Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Exeter and Specialist in Women's Writing. We'll be discussing Helen's new book, Why Women Read Fiction, which uses insight from hundreds of interviews and conversations with female writers and readers to explain how precious fiction is to women and how they draw on it to tell the stories of their lives. Welcome to the podcast, Helen.
Thank you.
First, could you talk about the journey that led you to writing this book?
Well, I wanted to write this book over two decades or more. As a teacher, I've always been fascinated by readers' very different responses to literature, and particularly fiction. And so I was fascinated always by the way that women discuss their reading in school, in, at college, at bus stops, in social gatherings. And women always wanted to talk about fiction to me. And I wrote a very scholarly book. I started to write a very scholarly book about Gone with the Wind in the 1980s. And I was trying to put the work into historical, racial, literary, cultural contexts. And everyone I spoke to who had read this book immediately began to tell me a personal story about it.
Right.
You know, how important it had been to them. And they knew exactly how it fitted into their own life narrative. And I thought, this is very interesting. And so I started to want to explore the whole business of women's reading, and it's taken me about 30 years to get around to it.
So when you did start to review the data from your more than 500 interviews, questionnaires and conversations, what sorts of themes began to emerge?
Well, most of all, I think the passion that women have for fiction. Women talked about it as a lifeline, my best friend, love of my life. They say they're bereft without a novel. I've never heard a man say that, but maybe some men do feel like that, but certainly a lot of women feel like that. So that was the first thing. Then I discovered that women have passionate lifelong associations with particular books and writers, often recalled in relation to particular contexts, places, home, of course, usually with mothers reading to them and mothers choosing books in the library for them and buying books for them, but also in school, libraries, bookshops, reading groups, festivals and so on. And I thought that the way that women draw on fictional characters and narratives in their own lives was very fascinating. And the final thing is that women take their reading terribly seriously. Especially through book clubs, which are predominantly female, in literary festivals, literary tourist adventures when they go to see, you know, Jane Austen's house or Haworth Parsonage. And they record lists of books often. Book club members have typed lists that they sent me of books that they read over decades. You know, all on spreadsheets with comments and things like that. So the seriousness with which women treat their fiction reading is awesome.
And did anything about the themes that emerge surprise you? Perhaps the idea of reading is associated with guilt even now, or that somehow the private sphere of reading is less sanctified than, say, watching TV with a partner?
Well, I think for a lot of women, reading still feels dangerous, subversive, powerful, which women are not used to feeling. From their early reading under bedclothes with a torch when they were supposed to be sleeping, to snatching time in a busy day or at bedtime, it's often a guilty pleasure. And women express this in terms of desserts or puddings. You know, they talk about a sweet treat. The, you know, it's something that, you know, you feel greedy, you feel voracious, a glutton. It's the editor and novelist William Thackeray referred to fiction that everyone loves as sweets, and he recommended roast non-fiction for a balanced diet. And I think one of the things women like about fiction is it's sweet.
What have you learned through your research about the role of reading fiction in offering a sense of connection to other lives and to shared experiences?
Well, Emily Dickinson said, "There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away." And I think there's something about reading fiction which makes us feel that we go lands away, we connect with other lands, with other people, with other experiences. The editor Guy Pringle talked of women's reading groups as the female equivalent of Freemasonry. And I think it's a very good way of putting it, because women enjoy the convivial intellectual stimulation of recommending and sharing fiction, discussing, arguing about it. And that gets them away from the solitariness of a lone reader. So although, of course, we all have to read fiction alone, the fact is that our connections with other women readers are what give it a real richness and depth. And it's not just in book clubs, it's through bookshop signings, festivals, literary societies. And literary societies are full of women. You'll get the odd man, but it's mainly women. And visits to fictional sites, you know, like Poldark's Cornwall, where they had to warn people not to go near Kynance Cove in Cornwall because so many people wanted to see one of the sites where the novel had been filmed. Mm. And women are the social secretaries of families. Women are undoubtedly the ones who said, I want to go and see Kynance Cove because that's where Poldark was filmed.
And could you talk about what the responses you've collected indicate about the changing relationships women may have with books and reading as they navigate through different stages of life?
Yes, we all want to read fiction that illuminates and clarifies who we are at any stage. So reading through life changes is one of the things that I found women particularly remember and value. Certain novels and reading experiences are associated with what women often call chapters of their lives. It's very interesting, this literary language that women use, chapters of their lives or narratives of their lives. In childhood, we read certain things. When we're teenagers, when we have a romantic life, when we partner somebody, when we have children, when we mature or move into old age, we often find that different fiction suits or is selected for that stage of our life or that chapter. Novels or short stories are recalled as crucial in periods of hospital stay, or even childbirth, chemotherapy sessions. A number of women who wrote and said to me, I loved reading fiction because it took away from the pain and the distress of chemotherapy. Holidays and days out, you know, women associating particular fiction with holidays. You know, we talk about airport books, and that's what airport books are, really. Mm-hmm. And women, a lot of women talked about reading romance when they were young and then growing out of it. I mean, some women don't. Some women read romances all through their lives, often to dissipate their own feelings of disappointment and disillusionment with their own romances. But a lot of women said, you know, I read a lot of it, as I did actually. I read Mills and Boone obsessively when I was a teenager. Mm. And then I sort of, you know, I got tired of it. I think I realised men weren't like the men in Mills and Boone, alas. And a lot of women, over 55-year-olds, are the largest readers of dark crime, really violent and horrible crime. People think, oh, well, older women probably avoid violent crime, but not a bit of it. And I think that's because it's exploring social issues. It's exploring the worst experiences or the darkest kinds of feelings and fears that women have had through their lives. And it's a way of exorcising it. Mm. Also, I think for a lot of women, their life experiences of domestic abuse, fear of violent women, even fear of walking down a street at night alone, those things are what you explore when you read violent crime. Mm.
You draw particular attention to two novels in your book, Austen's Pride and Prejudice and Bronte's Jane Eyre. What is it, do you think, about these two books that make them so popular with female readers?
Well, I think it's a historical thing, actually. For many years, these were regarded as great classics. They were sold in cheap versions in stores like Woolworths, now long gone, of course. They were read in abridged versions in primary schools, and they were set in set by enthusiastic women teachers in girls' schools. So there's a whole generation of women who grew up with those novels, and then they passed them on to their daughters, their granddaughters, you know, their siblings, their friends. And girls and women who were often encouraged to read male-authored texts about heroic men, I think, turned to Lizzie Bennet and Jane Eyre for their ordinariness. You know, neither of those heroines was a great beauty. Both of them were poor. They lived on their wits and their independence. And what happens, lo and behold, they become chosen by wealthy, desirable men because of their spirit. Mm. You know, because they had great spirit, which in both cases involves turning down proposals until the men are humbled. Now, what's not to like if you're a girl or a woman? And it's the great story of romance. This is the great story of romance that is absorbed into 20th and 20th century romance novels, which use the Pride and Prejudice and Jane Eyre stories obsessively. Barbara Cartland and many writers since then. Mm. And the novels, too, were adapted into some of cinema and TV's greatest productions with renowned eye candy, you know, Laurence Olivier's Rochester, Colin Firth's Mr. Darcy, and many more. And they've had an afterlife of their own because women writers have loved those novels. They've been rewritten, Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, Helen Fielding's Bridget Jones' Diary. There have been parodies, prequels, sequels, P.D. James's Death Comes to Pemberley, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I've never read this, but it sounds fascinating. Jean Rhys's Wide Sargasso Sea, which is a great novel rewriting of Jane Eyre. So the intense passion that women have for these has resulted also in high-profile societies devoted to each writer, and especially these novels. The Jane Austen Society, the Bronte Society, these are major national societies with women playing the main roles, women running them and creating imaginative events, processions, balls, often in costume. On it goes. So I think that they've been kind of sedimented into our cultural life.
Fascinating. As you note in the book, women make up the biggest proportion of book buyers, book club members, book bloggers, and literary festival attendees. Do you have any thoughts on why so-called women's fiction continues to be somewhat sidelined by the literary establishment, and any ideas on how we can continue to tip the scale towards equilibrium?
Well, if I knew that, I would be a very rich and powerful woman. In our society, male authority, values and priorities rule in almost every sphere of life, let's face it. I mean, people often say to me, oh, there are women working in publishing, but they're not at the top of publishing. You know, they're sort of a couple of layers down. The people who are at the top are men, and on the whole, newspaper editors and journals and so on. Mm. And men, which doesn't mean to say these are sexist men, it just means that the perspective is not primarily a female or feminine one. It's not surprising to me that women's fiction, that is, women writing by women, is sidelined. It's reviewed less. It's reviewed mainly by women. The number of women who said to me, I'm so sick of being just offered women's fiction and not male fiction. It's given less column inches and general attention. And there are statistics. Women reviewers and interest groups have produced really startling statistics to show this imbalance. And my book contains quotes from lots of women writers who are extremely fed up about how they're pigeonholed. You know, chick lit and hen lit are terms for which there's no male equivalent. And serious writers like Louise Doughty have been lumped as chick lit writers, when in fact none of her novels has any relationship to that kind of fluffiness, if you like. So until we live in an equal society, I think we have to keep challenging this. But I must say, I'm a little bit optimistic at the moment. The unquestioned success of writers such as J.K. Rowling, Zadie Smith, Hilary Mantel, Margaret Atwood, E.L. James, Bernardine Evaristo, it does suggest the tide may be turning. And, you know, maybe these women are setting a whole new trend for excitement about women's writing.
Let's hope so. You write in the book about the importance of public libraries. Do you anticipate the closure of so many around the UK may have an impact on continuing the reading tradition in girls and young women?
Oh, I think the closure and threats of closure of libraries is an absolute national scandal. So many of my correspondents and interviewees have their lives transformed by those democratic reading spaces and the books they found there free to borrow. And anytime you read an interview with a woman writer, she starts with the library. That's where she discovered how exciting and real reading was, and that's what she wanted to do. Do you know that there is a statutory duty for every prison in this country to have a library? Quite right too. But there is none, no statutory duty for schools to have a library. And the inspection service Ofsted does not look at library provision. Isn't that a scandal?
It is.
And so the future for young readers and all of us, as libraries continue to close, is going to be grim if these wonderful places just disappear.
The central question of your book, as you describe, is what does fiction reading mean to women? What have you discovered about possible answers to this rather large question through your work?
It's a huge question. And what I've discovered is it means a huge amount to women readers and those who would like to read. Let's remember that 2/3 of the world's illiterate are women. And Malala Yousafzai said, "Extremists have shown what frightens them most, a girl with a book." Reading empowers, educates, enlightens, and women who've traditionally received far less formal education than men have found reading the route to knowledge, you know, to intellectual and emotional understanding of the world. So my correspondents of all classes, race and ethnic backgrounds described how fiction reading gave them social mobility, enhanced their emotional intelligence, got them into good careers, help them understand and challenge a patriarchal world in which they were always subordinate, if not oppressed. So fiction gives women an oblique take on a world that's designed by and for men and offers characters as role models, narratives that suggest ways of changing the world, and words to shape new life stories.
And finally, it would be fantastic to hear about a few of your favourite novels, the ones that make up your literary scape, and why they are so important to you.
Well, I quote in the book Evelyn Glennie on the soundscape we all have of our music listening lives, you know, the soundtrack of life, as others put it. And I think women have a literary soundscape, so it's almost impossible for me to describe mine, most of my correspondents did much better than I could. But here's a taster of mine. I owe my childhood fascination with Swiss mountains and Exmoor to Heidi and Lorna Doone. I loved Enid Blyton, especially the magic faraway tree, which still affects the way I look up at tall trees. I imagine that world going round at the top of trees. And Little Women, and I am an absolutely typical reader of my generation, Little Women gave me a model of a girly swot like me. In Jo March. I loved her and I thought, yes, it's all right to be a girly swot. And all three Bronte sisters who were introduced to me by my mother, my teachers, my girlfriends, all three of them remain very close to my heart because of their wonderful works and also their astonishing lives, beginning with writing those little tiny books as children. And I noticed that the Bronte Society has just bought one of the little books to put in the Haworth Parsonage. There's such an extraordinary sight, you know, to think of starting writing on little tiny pieces of paper. And I did that too. And the writers of my mature years, I went to live and study in the American South, and I first discovered African-American novelists. I'd never heard of Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, James Baldwin. Isn't that shocking? And I loved them all, and they remain some of my favourite writers. And then later, because of feminist presses like Virago and the Women's Press, I discovered Zora Neale Hurston, Toni Morrison and other African-American writers. I knew nothing about slavery and the history of the South, and these writers made me understand slavery and history and feel it on the pulses. Other brilliant American writers whom I love and have written about, like Kate Chopin, Eudora Welty, Edith Wharton, they taught me about the different regions and historical periods of the USA. And in recent years, I've enjoyed writers such as Hilary Mantel,
Ali Smith, Bernardine Evaristo with their quirky takes on women of different kinds. And two novels that I in recent years that I have loved. I love David Nichols' One Day. That's a classic sort of romance written by a man. Love it. And Anna Burns' Milkman knocked me out. I think it's the most brilliant novel. And I've written a lot about Daphne du Maurier, whom I still believe is badly underrated. Mm-hmm.
Some excellent choices and ones to which I'm sure many of us can relate. So thank you so much for speaking with me today, Helen. There's so much to discuss on this subject, but you've provided a lot of food for thought about the female reading experience. If our listeners would like to learn more, Why Women Read Fiction by Helen Taylor is available online and in shops across the UK now, and will publish in the US at the start of the new year. Thank you for listening.